Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
It's Here and Now. Samuel Alito is winning high praise and is expected to win an easy victory in the Senate Judiciary Committee today. All 10 Republican committee members say they will support Alito, while a majority of the 8 Democrats on the committee say they'll oppose the nomination. Despite his likely confirmation, critics are still rallying hard to convince Republicans to shift their votes when the full Senate takes up the issue. Protesters outside the Capitol building are waving signs with slogans like, "Oppose Alito, save Roe, and stop Alito." Earlier this week, anti-abortion protesters held placards in favor of the candidate. Well, Gail Chadwick joins us now. She's congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, and she's at these hearings. And Gail, I just want to start with, you know, as we've said in the past, a lot has been made of these confirmation proceedings having, extra stagecraft, you know, senators playing a role rather than getting to substance. So how's the run-up to the vote going today?
Well, I don't think you could ask for any more drama around a nomination. To have this come, you know, the day after big demonstrations in support and in opposition to Roe v. Wade, to have them come a week where the president is on a full court press to convince the public that authorization of wiretaps without a warrant was within the scope of presidential powers, the Alito nomination fits squarely in both those concerns. Reproductive rights and executive power. So there's a lot of high drama around this and a lot of disappointment. You know, for the liberal groups who've been supporting this Democrats just on the fight for the Supreme Court, this is the swing vote on the Supreme Court, the Sandra Day O'Connor vote, and they're very disappointed that it looks as if Democrats are not going to go for a filibuster of this nomination.
I guess that's been the criticism, that there's high drama certainly around the nomination, but not enough for some in the hearing room. So what's been happening this morning? What are people saying?
Well, pretty much what they've said before. What you're seeing is Democrats rallying around the themes of executive power, civil rights, and privacy. Not just for this nomination, but also for the midterm elections. A lot of the Democrats I'm talking about are already looking to point back at this nomination and say, had we a Senate controlled by Democrats, we could have blocked this nomination, but we didn't. So there is a feeling of letdown in the sense that I don't feel that they're going to go ahead and press for a filibuster. But they do have a lot in the Democratic base who are going to be very disappointed.
Well, you mentioned this possibility of a filibuster, and the Democrats have, many said they will not approach that. But what does happen now? If, as expected, Samuel Alito is confirmed in committee today, then what happens?
We go to a debate on the floor of the Senate. But the final vote hasn't been determined yet. Democrats have not agreed to a vote this week, which is what Republicans had wanted. If it looks like that's not going to happen this week, you could expect Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist to press for cloture, which would force a vote before the President's State of the Union on the 31st. That's the goal. Republicans want the President to be able to come to the full Congress with at least this victory notched under his belt as a talking point.
So conceivably, there could be a vote held by the end of this week, and Samuel Alito could be a Supreme Court judge by early next week.
Yes.
That could happen. And you mentioned that, you know, all the protesters outside the building, both yesterday and some today. Is there a real sense in Washington that the fate of abortion law is in Alito's hands? He did say during the hearings that, he refused to say that Roe v. Wade was settled law. Is that an assumption?
Not quite, because when you do the math, even assuming that Judge Alito and Chief Justice Roberts take every chance they have to curb the rights under Roe v. Wade, you're still short one vote. On many issues, Alito will be the swing vote. But abortion, they still need one more vote. So the conservative groups are already saying that the key vote for them is going to be the next one, which could be Justice Stevens.
Gail Chad, a congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. She's speaking to us on the line from the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings in Washington, D.C., where the vote on Samuel Alito's nomination to the Supreme Court is expected to take place any moment today, and it is expected to be in favor of his nomination, at least from the committee. It then goes to the Senate. Gail, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, Gail mentioned the president's State of the Union speech next week, in which President Bush is expected to push for sweeping reform to U.S. health care policy. The president is expected to call for additional tax breaks, including making out-of-pocket medical expenses, such as co-payments, tax deductible. But that is part of a bigger move on the part of the president's advisors and some conservative policy analysts who want to change longstanding policy and shift more of the cost of health care from employers to workers. It's part of an effort to make workers more aware of the high cost of health care and perhaps use less of it. Joining us on the line is one of the leading thinkers on this topic, Glenn Hubbard. He's dean of the Columbia University Business School. He's the former chair of President Bush's Council of Economic Advisors and co-author of the new book, Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise, which is published by the conservative American Enterprise Institute, where Hubbard is also a visiting scholar. Professor Hubbard, Glenn, welcome.
Thank you.
Professor, polls show most Americans think they're underinsured. Do you really think they're using insurance too much?
Well, I think one thing we learn from polls is that people are unhappy with the costs and access they have to health care. And part of that is a question of what could we do to actually make health care markets work better. You know, health care is about a sixth of the American economy. In the other five-sixths, we do what we can to make markets work better. In healthcare, we've actually frustrated markets, making individuals have access to perhaps lower quality care than they might otherwise get.
But critics of the current healthcare coverage say consumers use it too much because they think someone else will pay for it. Do you agree?
I do agree. About five out of every $6 spent on healthcare in the United States is spent by somebody other than the consumer. That kind of so-called third-party payer problem makes it the case that we don't care as much about the cost of our care. And there's some easy policy steps that would lower health care costs for individuals without affecting health care outcomes. And if we can lower health care costs, we can raise everybody's wages. Nothing is a free lunch. We all pay for all of this in terms of our lost wages. The question is, do we do it through an employer, a private insurer, or the government?
And you and others would like to see people do it themselves so that they get a more upfront sense of what it costs. You're proposing a two-pronged approach. The first, higher copays, as we said, to feel the cost of care, but also make those copays tax-deductible. What would that do?
Well, what we really want to do is make sure that the tax code doesn't determine how you finance your health care spending. At the moment, you get a lot of a tax break if your employer buys your health insurance policy, so much so that what people call insurance is really prepaid health care. But if I try to buy my own insurance, if I'm self-employed or if I want to go to the doctor on my own, I don't get the subsidies. Let's have the same treatment for all those transactions.
Now, we should say there are some people with that thinking in mind who say that health care benefits from employers should be part of someone's income. In other words, if, let's say, you get about $10,000, I'm just guessing, of health care coverage, that should be part of your income and should be taxed.
And that, frankly, is a very fine solution, but I think that's remote.
Well, most people think that that would be, I mean, people would just rebel if their health care benefits were taxed. But you are suggesting instead to make out-of-pocket payments, co-pays, for instance, tax-deductible. Toward what end?
Well, again, we would make the same tax treatment for all of health care. So if your employer buys your insurance, you don't pay tax. If you took the money as wages and you bought your own insurance, no tax. Or if you go to the doctor yourself and pay, no tax.
You just mentioned another part of your proposal. As you said, take some of your wages and use them for health care. These are the health savings accounts. How do they work?
Correct. With a health savings account, you would be able to deposit money tax-free into an account that could be used to buy insurance, to pay for your own medical care, or to save for future medical care.
It's a very flexible
way to prepare for yourself.
You use the phrase skin in the game to describe these processes. What does that mean?
We all pay for health care out of our wages, no matter who we think is paying for it. But if you do it in an obvious way, like a health savings account, I ask myself, you know, do I really want that expenditure, or should I shop around?
Well, as you well know, there are a lot of critics of this thinking. First of all, people say that if you give individuals the opportunity to opt out of employer plans, it might be the healthy, wealthy employees who do that, those who are looking for the tax benefits, and you lose the benefit of pooling risk, and only the people who are sick and less well-paid will stay in these employer plans.
Those criticisms are legitimate, and that's why in the book we don't just talk about tax reform. We also talk about reforms that would make insurance markets work better by removing some of the state regulations. And we also talk about a plan to subsidize healthcare expenses for the chronically ill so that no one gets left behind by reform.
Does it seem, though, that in shifting more financial costs to the average payer, you're also shifting the blame? When it's doctors who prescribe expensive procedures and hospitals who have more incentives to do them because they're reimbursed for them, as opposed to many low-cost preventive procedures, wouldn't it be smarter to move toward an insurance system that reimburses for low-cost preventive measures?
Absolutely. And if you do create these more market-friendly incentives, individuals empowered by new information that we talk about in the book might well invest much more in prevention. When we have employer-based insurance, there's an incentive to shop for the cheapest insurance all the time, but that insurance may have less prevention. When you have a more viable individual market, I think you'll see a lot more investment in preventive care. You're absolutely right.
And what would you say to employers, and there are some, for instance, quoted in this week's American Prospect magazine, who say that they, in fact, want to be the ones to pay for their workers' health policies because they want to ensure that they have healthy and productive workers?
And they could absolutely do that. All we're saying in our plan is to make the incentives neutral. So if the employer is the right pool or that's the right arrangement, fine. But many individuals are trapped in the plans that they don't necessarily want because they're not able to go out on the individual market and get the same subsidy.
And what about the government? What do you think the government's role is in helping people with health insurance?
I think the government has several roles here. One is to make sure that insurance markets are working better. Also, to help low-income people buy insurance. So we do propose a refundable health insurance tax credit for low-income people. And also, we believe the government has a larger role to play in the care for the chronically ill. Because if you're chronically ill, that's not really an insurable event. For such people, expenses are predictably, not randomly, high. And it's very hard to make insurance markets work. So we offer ways in which government can play an expanded role to help with the chronically ill.
Glenn Hubbard is dean of the Columbia University Business School. He's the former chair of President Bush's Council of Economic Advisors and co-author of the new book, Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise, calling for Americans who can to pay more for their health care, to be rewarded with tax deductions, to be sure, but to pay more to avoid frivolous use of insurance. Well, when we return, a very different take from a health policy analyst who says no one's being frivolous. He says the solution lies in prevention, in preventing serious problems like obesity. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. It's Here and Now, and we're continuing our talk about health care reform. President Clinton and then First Lady Hillary Clinton were accused of overreaching in the early 90s when they tried to revamp the nation's employer-based health insurance system. Well, now President Bush is taking a stab at it. He's expected to outline his health care reform proposals in his State of the Union speech next week. Reform that, as we just heard, will attempt to shift more health care costs to consumers to help make people see how costly care is. In some cases, people might have to pay more for co-pays and out-of-pocket deductibles, but President Bush would allow to deduct these expenses from their taxes. Joining us on the line is Kenneth Thorpe, chair of the Health Policy Department at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. Welcome back, Ken.
Well, thanks for having me.
And do you agree with Glenn Hubbard and other of the president's economic advisors who say most Americans are using insurance too much? They're overinsured.
Well, I think they've got the diagnosis of the problem fundamentally incorrect. Clearly, health care needs to be reformed, and if the Clintons overreach, this is certainly one that underreaches dramatically. And I think before you get out with a major restructuring proposal, you have to understand what's driving the growth in spending in the first place. And the key drivers are really technology and a rise in the share of Americans that have a variety of chronic illnesses, such as diabetes, high cholesterol levels, asthma, and so on.
What are you saying, that they don't have a choice in their health care?
That's right. I mean, if you look at where we spend our health care dollar, about 80% of it is traced to patients that have a chronic disease. And as Professor Hubbard noted, you know, that's not an issue of insurance. That's an issue of how best to clinically provide health care services to those populations.
Right. Because insurance is for the random, and it's a bet that you make that you're going to stay healthy. It's for the random illness, whereas chronic care is constant.
That's right. It's a predictable expense, which means that part of the solution is not an insurance issue. It really is restructuring how we deliver health services to chronically ill patients.
Well, as you know, Mr. Hubbard and the president's advisors have said that they want the government to be more involved with the chronically ill, and that they feel that the health care savings that they can see from their new plan will give the government more money to do that. Let's talk about the proposal. Glenn Hubbard makes the argument that under current tax policy, people deduct employer-provided health expenses, but not their own out-of-pocket expenses. And he says, as a result, they're motivated to purchase low copay insurance rather than pay more out-of-pocket. And that leads to cost unconsciousness and wasteful practices. Do you agree that, you know, people are taking more tests and, you know, driving up the cost of insurance unnecessarily?
No, again, I mean, the problem of rising health care costs is not traced to an epidemic of crazed moms bringing their kids to pediatricians. I mean, that's just a fundamental misdiagnosis of the problem. You know, remember that employers choose health plans that they offer to the workers. You know, about 180 million people get their coverage through an employer. So what individuals get to choose from is usually two types of a managed care plan, in some cases a medical savings account as well. So I guess I'm confused by their thinking on this issue.
Well, they do feel that if people do use the medical savings accounts, you know, when you have a certain amount of money and you draw out of it to pay for your own health care and it comes from your wages, or if there are higher copays, and this is all an approach sometimes called consumer-directed health care, people will think twice before a procedure. But you're saying you don't think that's the problem.
Well, certainly, I mean, that's not to say that there is not a role in the marketplace for medical savings accounts. I absolutely think that there is. I think the problem is you can't oversell their impact it's going to have on healthcare spending. This small segment of the population that would be attracted to HSAs, well, sure, you know, they may discourage some type of utilization. But when you're looking at a $1.7 trillion health economy, the savings likely to stem from that are going to be trivial.
Well, I have another question, and I wished I'd asked Professor Hubbard this question, but instead I'll address it to you. It seems to me that most people, when they're in the middle of a health crisis, don't have time to think about it. I'm thinking of one time when I took my mom, per order of her doctor, to the hospital. We spent 2 days there. Nothing happened. We decided not to go through the procedure, but still the bill was $8,000 to Medicare and $900 copay to my mom. And yet, in the middle of that crisis, you know, wanting to do what was right for her, I don't know if I would have asked what the copay was before going into the hospital.
Well, that's right. And you know, not only that, if you are pulling people out of the group market, out of employment-based coverage, and buying coverage on your own, the prices that you're going to be charged are going to be substantially higher. You know, one of the things that group policies do is negotiate lower prices with hospitals and healthcare providers. And if you're out there on your own with the individual policy, you're going to pay something close to the full charges of those services. So, you know, in some cases, I do have acquaintances who have health savings accounts, and they have been absolutely stunned by the bills that they get for services that they thought they were you know, effectively shopping for.
Right. There were other suggestions from Professor Hubbard, and we may hear them from the president as well, to remove state regulations that require insurers to cover certain types of care, for instance, chiropractic care, which some consumers might not want in a plan, but some states might require, to allow insurers to sell their plans nationwide so they don't have these over 1,000 state regulations to consider, and to cap damages in medical malpractice suits. Do you see any benefits there?
Well, certainly, you know, we need to be careful looking at additional mandates on health insurance. But, you know, one of the important roles that state regulation plays is to make sure that the insurance that you purchase is solid. And one of the big concerns of removing state regulation and oversight from health plans is that you could have a variety of unscrupulous providers and health plans come in that don't have the capital reserves in place to actually pay the bills when they come due.
Hmm. Professor Thorpe, it sounds as if you think that what has to happen with health care is there has to be more preventive health care.
Right. I mean, it's got to focus on population initiatives to reduce the growth of obesity. You know, that's got to start in the schools and at the work site. I mean, this is really an obesity-driven increase in disease prevalence. Interacting with technologies, you know, that's a new therapeutic interventions coming on the market that's driving spending up. And if you sort of look at that as a diagnosis of the problem, which, you know, I believe it is, and then match it up with these high-deductible health plans, it's just missing the boat.
Well, the debate continues. It's one we'll hear about over the next couple of weeks for sure. Ken, thank you.
Okay, my pleasure.
Kenneth Thorpe, chairman of the Health Policy Department at Emory University, Atlanta, Georgia. And again, President Bush will present his health care reform proposals in his State of the Union next Tuesday. Some are already saying it is tax reform as well as health reform. And we'll continue to cover it. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for It's Here and Now. A European investigator today added to the charges that the CIA outsourced torture by setting up a network of secret prisons in Europe, and he also claimed that European governments knew what was going on. Swiss Senator Dick Marty released a preliminary report today to the human watchdog agency, the Council of Europe. The report claims the U.S. government has ferried more than 100 people to detention centers in countries such as Romania and Poland to be tortured. While there is evidence that detainees were transported, Senator Marty admits he has no hard proof that secret prisons exist. Well, joining us now is Christopher Dickey, Paris Bureau Chief and Middle East Editor for Newsweek. He's on the line from Davos, Switzerland. And Chris, tell us more about today's news.
Basically, you have Dick Marty, who's a member of Parliament in Switzerland, who's been leading an investigation for the Council of Europe, and he's looking into a couple of questions. First are the black sites, the secret prisons that may or may not exist in Poland, Romania, other places in Eastern Europe. And secondly, the question of renditions, people being snatched off the streets or otherwise picked up, hustled onto planes, maybe drugged, in many cases probably drugged, and flown to countries, either Afghanistan, Egypt, possibly other places, where they can be worked over at length, tortured, in fact, questioned in ways that probably would be proscribed under European law, and eventually, the CIA hopes, made to talk. The problem with this, of course, is that it's in contravention of many European laws. So all of this is very controversial here in Europe, and what Marty is saying is that the European governments knew what was happening. They just chose to turn a blind eye, and they are complicit in this whole, as he puts it, illegal operation.
Well, let's be clear. When he says European governments knew what was going on, what have governments acknowledged? Did they know just about the rendition?
They haven't acknowledged that they knew anything, mm-hmm. except that there were planes landing at some of their airports and coming and going on different occasions. And they can't really deny that because the flight records are now public records in many cases. And you even had in Spain, for instance, you had hobbyists, plane spotters, taking pictures of CIA planes on the runways landing and taking off in places like Mallorca. So they can't deny that the planes have traveled around, and they can't deny that people have been picked up in a few cases. There's a famous German case where a naturalized German of Egyptian background went to go on vacation in Macedonia, got picked up at the border in Macedonia, held for 3 weeks in a hotel in Macedonia, questioned day and night, eventually put in a diaper, drugged, naked, taken to Afghanistan, and questioned there for months. Even when they realized that he was telling the truth, that he was not who they thought he was, they took a long time to let him go. He's now back in Germany, and he's obviously suing the hell out of the United States, the German government, and anybody else that his lawyers can focus on. Then you've got Abu Omar, famous case, another Egyptian snatched off the street in Milan in February of 2003, thrown into a truck, driven to Aviano Air Base, again drugged, taken to Egypt. The Egyptians questioned him for months, eventually actually let him out. He called his wife in Milan, said, "This is what happened to me," called another imam in Milan, said, "This is what happened to me." The Egyptians picked him up again, and we haven't heard from him since. So those are well-known cases, and those are the ones that Marty is focusing on. And he's basically saying that none of this could have happened without at least the Secret Services knowing full well that the Americans were going to be playing these games and carrying out these kinds of operations.
Well, some of the most heavily publicized claims that there were secret prisons in Romania and Poland. Can you tell us what is believed to have happened in those countries?
That story really is not, and that investigations into those sites really has not advanced very much since the original story about these so-called black sites came out in the Washington Post several months ago. Since then, we've seen and heard indications of flights by CIA planes to obscure military bases in Poland, in Romania. And then there has been an extrapolation from that to say probably that's where the black sites are. But I don't know of any solid proof of that, any really reliable evidence. And Marty has had no success turning up, and he says this, no success turning up any substantial information about those sites. He says he's just not getting the cooperation he needs.
Chris Dickey, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Christopher Dickey, Paris Bureau Chief and Middle East Editor for Newsweek, speaking to us from Davos, Switzerland. Well, we now turn to Terry Davis, a former British Member of Parliament and the Secretary General of the Council of Europe. He joins us from the organization's headquarters in Strasbourg, France. And Mr. Davis, as we said, there is a lack of any formal evidence of these secret detention centers. Dennis McShane, a British Member of Parliament, has said that the Swiss investigator Dick Marty's report has more holes than a Swiss cheese. Your reaction?
Well, I think Mr. Marty has been quite clear. He has produced a report which is a compilation of what is known fact. There are several cases where he's identified countries and names of people who have been arrested and taken to other countries where they are at risk of being tortured. So I think Dennis McShane is being a bit unfair, but the other point I'd make is I've known Dennis McShane for a long time. I've known him for more than 30 years before he was a Member of Parliament. Dennis is a colourful man, and he sometimes does go over the top in his language.
Well, we know you're also trying to gain access to detention centres in Kosovo, which are under the control of NATO troops, but NATO officials say that the detention centres are empty. So what are you hoping to find there?
Well, this is a rather strange story. United Nations have said, and they did this nearly 2 years ago, they're very happy for us to have access to their places of detention, but they could not give access to those places controlled by NATO. And so we wrote to NATO, and that's now 18 months ago, and asked for access. There have been a number of meetings since. I've sent several letters since. And we still have not been given access. And so I simply raise the question, if NATO have nothing to hide, why can't we go and have a look?
The U.S. government has called this practice of transporting prisoners to jails in other countries extraordinary rendition. And on a recent trip to Europe, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said the U.S. does use the practice of rendition, but denies that it's for the purpose of torturing the prisoners. Your response?
I did notice that Condoleezza Rice chose her words carefully, and she referred only to torture. There is also the issue of inhumane, degrading, cruel treatment. And the European Court of Human Rights decided some years ago that those words included, for example, depriving people of sleep for long periods, subjecting them to excessive noise, things of that sort. Which could not perhaps be described as torture, but certainly could be described as cruel. I would be very pleased if Condoleezza Rice would deny the use of such interrogation techniques.
Do you have a sense of how people across Europe are reacting to this story? There was a huge outcry when it first was made public. As it continues to trickle out, as investigations are attempted, what are people saying that you hear?
I think people are very concerned indeed. European newspapers are certainly reporting the allegations extensively and conducting their own investigations. Some of the facts which have been established have been done by investigative journalists here in Europe.
Terry Davis, former British Member of Parliament and the Secretary General of the Council of Europe. He spoke with us from the organization's headquarters in Strasbourg, France. Thank you very much for speaking with us, Mr. Davis.
Thank you very much indeed.
And still to come, the future of regional theater. We ask one of its leading lights if that future is dimming. You're listening to Here and Now. Feeling a little down? Well, there might be a reason. A British psychologist who specializes in seasonal disorders has developed a mathematical formula showing that January 24th is the most depressing day of the year. Well, actually, we just found out it's the Monday closest to January 24th, so we are a day late, and we're a little depressed about that, but we decide to call him anyway, and Cliff Arnall joins us on the line from Brecon in Wales. Cliff, welcome.
Hi there.
And I'm realizing now we're a day late, so we should actually be feeling better.
That's right. You should be feeling tons better now. How good is that to miss the day?
But why the Monday near the 24th, first of all?
It's really what people have reported. So they have fun on the weekend, and then the realization that they have to go back to work, and the fact that the mornings are dark. It's that kind of thing, just that Monday morning feeling.
Right. And why the 24th? We understand you developed a formula for a television travel channel that wanted to analyze when people book trips. So tell us about that. Tell us about your formula.
Yeah, you're right. The original request came in from a travel company, and they were really interested in what would be the best day in January to book a summer holiday. So when I started talking to people, what was very interesting were the kind of things that they were saying, and it seemed to be the need to look forward to something was very strong, mm-hmm. but there were a number of factors associated with that. So what I did was got together the formula, which includes all of the key factors, and it came out as the 23rd for this year, 23rd of January for this year, as the most depressing day. So this is the time when people really wanted to, wanting to do something positive, but we're also kind of feeling a little bit lethargic and low as well.
And we should say we've seen the math. It's all over it's like a real math formula of all these aspects that you put in. And a spokesperson for a PR firm in London told MSNBC that it's true that people are more likely to buy, what they consider a ticket to paradise when they feel like hell, when they're not feeling well.
Yeah, that's right. That actually taps into one of the reasons we're human, really, we are adaptable. And when we're feeling low, then there's a big part of us that says, we need to get out of this. We need to take some action. That's one of the key factors in the formula, the NA, the need to take action. And it really is encouraging that when people are feeling like this, that there's this urge, almost like a primitive urge, to want to do something that'll help them out, that they can look forward to.
We should, say you are a psychologist. This is a serious subject, seasonal depression, depression of any kind.
It is. And whilst it was originally stemmed from a PR company, I am a psychologist. And the reason I'm particularly interested in this, is twofold. One is that this gets people talking about depression, about winter blues. And certainly in the UK, there's still a big stigma about being depressed, being down. I think that's wrong. I mean, it is a serious condition, and it affects people individually and also their families and friends. So talking about it is a good thing. I think the second thing is to use the most depressed day as a springboard for making positive, practical changes as well. And that could mean, say tonight, for example, is watching a DVD that makes you laugh,
right.
buying some fresh flowers.
But what about taking, doing, as they say, a geographic, booking that trip to paradise? Does that help?
Well, it depends on a number of factors. If you can afford it, then that's good. If it's escapism, that's not so good, because the truth is you take a nice trip away, then you're going to come back to what you had before, really, even though that you've topped up your energy level. So as long as it's people are doing it and they can afford it and they're not running away, then definitely it's a good idea.
Cliff Arnall, a psychologist in Wales. He developed a formula to identify the most depressing day of the year and came up with January 24th, or the Monday right before it, which, of course, would have been yesterday. Mr. Arnell, I just wish you a happy day.
Yeah, thank you very much. You too.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Here and now. This weekend, the Trinity Repertory Theater in Providence, Rhode Island unveils its staging of Shakespeare's Hamlet, the first production since the arrival of new artistic director Kurt Columbus. Kurt comes to Providence from Chicago, where he was the associate artistic director of the Steppenwolf Theater. So we're talking about big players in the regional theater world here. But in an age where the options for staying home and being entertained by cable, video games, and internet movie services like Netflix are expanding, does live theater still matter? Here now's Deborah Becker recently spoke to Columbus about the state of regional theater and how it's changed since September 11th.
I've watched a lot of my colleagues feeling as if they need to retrench, as if they need to make safe choices. And I've talked to a lot of people at national conventions who say, gosh, I'd like to do this, but I'm not sure that I can because risk-taking in this current climate, well, you know. And then my experience in Chicago has been really interesting because I've been involved with a theater like Steppenwolf, which sort of has built its identity around the notion of risk-taking or of itself as a risk-taker. So we've managed to continue to do out there things. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's been so great to stay in Chicago all this time.
Right. Oh, well, I just wonder if in Chicago at Steppenwolf and then at Trinity Rep, they were both sort of seen as these scrappy little theaters that could and did. They went from these little nothing places to established theaters.
Yeah.
Does that say something about where regional theater is right now to you, and do you see those similarities, or am I just seeing them as an outsider?
No, I absolutely see those similarities. I mean, it's one of the reasons I wanted this job. You know, Trinity is the unique opportunity for me because the audience here has a history of accepting challenging work, and it's also a theater that's based around the notion of company and a company of actors. Yeah, that was certainly the attraction in coming here. But, you know, Deb, the other thing, I mean, I can't stress this enough. It's really this notion of the audience or the community that is receptive to the notion of the theater as its destination, you know? That's a unique thing.
Explain that to me.
Well, theater is the last medium in our culture that privileges dialogue. Movie and television are ignorant of our presence, right?
Hmm.
Radio talks at you. Even the internet.
Come on.
Well, unless it's a call-in show, right? And radio and internet both have this anonymity that allows one not to own one's point of view. Theater is actually shaped by the presence of an audience, right?
Hmm.
I mean, they're breath in a room, if you will, breathes the thing to life. So, you know, we can't do without an audience, and therefore it is the last moment in our culture where we can have dialogue.
But is our culture at a time with Netflix and all of these other things that essentially remove us, is our culture at a time to embrace the regional theater, or where are we?
I think people are actually starving for dialogue and for the opportunity for dialogue. And going forward at Trinity, that's one of the things that we're going to exploit more and more and more.
What about the stereotype that so much theater is centered around New York City and Broadway? Does that still exist?
Saying that Broadway has a direct relationship to the regional theater movement is like suggesting that, Las Vegas has a direct relationship to museums of contemporary art. There's a way in which an entirely different set of forces shape what goes on those stages. I also think that often New York audiences, and perhaps because a lot of them are out-of-town audiences, those audiences are driven by reviews, whereas many regional theater audiences are driven, in fact, by their commitment to their theater.
Because those cynical reviewers, they don't know anything anyway. You know, actually, you moved closer to New York, do you?
I know I did. Heaven forfend. But I actually don't have a cynical relationship with reviewers. I have a number of close colleagues who are reviewers with whom I have a very active and aggressive dialogue about the state of the theater and my work in specific.
At Trinity, you're taking over for Oscar Eustis, the former director. He has gone to New York's public theater. He had sort of overall very glowing reviews, but sometimes mixed reviews for trying to combine thought-provoking or challenging work with some of the more populist kinds of things that maybe are review-driven. But I'm wondering, how do you plan to draw that need and balance this idea that you would like to present more challenging work, but you still have the realities of fundraising and marketing and trying to put out things that will attract large audiences so you can hit the bottom line?
Yeah. No, there's a really very simple answer to that, Deb, and that is I am focusing my attention on the company of actors. You know, Trinity has this one might even say unique company of actors in the American theater. They are a resident company. They are a year-round company, if you will. That doesn't exist many places. So I feel that instead of limiting the kind of work that I can do, it gives me a lot more freedom. For example, if I want to do a Neil Simon play, you know, Barefoot in the Park, I'm not doing it because of the commercial nature of the title. I'm doing it because I actually have four roles or six roles or whatever, great roles for my actors. Now, it happens to be a recognizable title, and people want to come and see that, but they're going to see these amazing actors enliven this work that in other hands might feel commercial. That's where focusing on this group of artists will give me latitude in the areas that you're talking about, marketing, development, that sort of thing. And I also, gosh, it's just so hard because I don't know that those things can ever drive the bus.
Maybe not drive the bus, but, I'm just wondering about the balance.
Yeah, I know how to build a balance. In fact, if you express yourself as an artist, as an artistic director, then it's actually your job to figure out how the rhythm of the season at one moment is entertaining, at the next moment is dramatic, at the next moment is enlightening, and that if you come with me from the beginning of my season to the end of my season, you will have all of these plays in conversation, you will see all of these artists being used in a variety of ways, and you'll go to an incredible number of places. I mean, I have to balance what's commercial with what's challenging. I have to balance what is necessary for the community with what is necessary for the, you know, the notion of higher art, all of that.
Sounds like a lot of juggling.
You know, I've been wanting to do this since I was 18 years old. So I'm actually the luckiest guy in the world. Is it challenging? Sure. Am I up for the challenge? Well, yeah, I've kind of been preparing for it my whole life.
Providence, Rhode Island's Trinity Rep Theater Artistic Director Kurt Columbus speaking to Here and Now's Deborah Becker. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.